This is Meet the People. I'm Kels Hetherington. On December 21, 2010, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia granted preliminary approval of a $3.4 billion settlement in the case of Cobell versus Salazar. This was a class action lawsuit about individual Indian land, funds, and other assets held in trust by the federal government. The courts decided that the federal government had violated its trust duties, including a duty to account for so-called individual Indian money trust funds. Joining me on Meet the People today to discuss this is attorney Justin Gilder, who is on the legal team handling the plaintiff's side of the case. Welcome to Meet the People, Mr. Gilder.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Well, thanks for coming on the radio. We want to know more about what is going on with this case and with the preliminary settlement. I gave, of course, a quick synopsis there, but maybe you could tell us a bit more about how this legal action started and where its roots are.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. First, this legal action really started in 1887 when the Dawes Act was passed by Congress, which was Congress's effort to break up tribally held land in the western United States. And that process resulted in the breakup of tribal lands into generally three categories of land. One was reserved for tribal reservations. The second was reserved for open settlement. And the third was land given to individual Indians for them to hold as their own land. Congress's thought at the time was this would allow Indians to essentially become farmers and own property individually as opposed to collectively, thinking that that would bring Indians into what Congress wanted them, how Congress wanted them to live at the time. And thinking that individual Indians couldn't manage their land, Congress said, we're going to hold the land in trust for 25 years and then give you the land. Ultimately, Congress decided that they were going to hold the land in trust in perpetuity. And so still today, there's a trust system in place for both those individual lands I mentioned, as well as trust lands for the tribes. But our case is not about the tribally held land. It's about land given to individual Indians. And that trust management system that's been in place for over 120 years includes all of the asset management. So if an individual in, say, Oklahoma has land with productive oil wells, it's the Department of Interior who manages that lease, executes that lease, collects the money, and then is supposed to distribute that money out to the individual beneficiary who owns the land. And that's the same situation across the western United States as well as in Alaska for any land that is owned by an individual Indian in what's called trust or restricted status. And all the money that's collected off of those lands is held into IIM accounts, individual Indian money accounts. And the United States, as trustee, had never performed a historical accounting of the trust. They had never given the beneficiaries, now which number in over 500,000 people, an historical accounting saying exactly where their land was, exactly what leases were on the land, how much money had been generated, and how much money had been collected and paid out. And a trustee is required by trust law to do that, but they had never done it.
All right. Now, so this went on for many, many years, and finally, somehow, Eloise Cobell gets involved in the situation because her name is in the case, right?
Yes. Eloise Cobell, who is a member of the Blackfeet in Montana, heard about the history from her fellow tribal members, as many other Indians have heard from other elders about the money that's from their land and what information they need, because people have struggled to get this information for generations from the government. And Eloise Cobell had heard about it for years. She was elected the treasurer of Blackfeet, and she was trying to help and fight for people's information. And she realized how bad the problem really was. She worked hard with Congress, actually, at a point in time to develop legislation to force the federal government to perform this historical accounting. That legislation was passed in 1994. It was called the Trust Reform Act, and it required the federal government to perform a historical accounting. And 2 years later, the government had done nothing, and Eloise Cobell decided that the government was never going to make any change happen without being prodded, and she decided to bring this legal action.
Now, Mr. Gilder, suing the federal government is not exactly the easiest thing to do. How does it work? And am I correct that you actually need to get the government's permission before you can proceed against the federal government with a lawsuit? Is that right?
It is difficult, but you don't have to get the government's permission. Really what it is there's in the law there's this general doctrine of sovereign immunity, which actually goes back to the England's theory that the king could do no wrong. So we adopted that system and said that the government cannot be sued except when the government has given permission in the sense of legislation that authorizes certain types of litigation. So at one point in time, essentially nobody could sue the government. Now there are broad categories of lawsuits that can be brought against the federal government. Some of them are in other cases for torts like simple battery and different things like that, and that falls under what's called the Federal Torts Claims Act. But here this action was brought to force the government to perform an action, and an action that they were required to do by law. So there's something called the Administrative Procedure Act, and what it allows is people who are harmed by government inaction to bring a lawsuit to compel action that the government is required to do. And so we brought an action to both under that APA Act as well as the general trust common law that I talked about before, because a trustee has these duties, whether they're the federal government or any other trustee, and trust law has been established for over 800 years. So it's an interesting meld of both federal law and trust law.
So most of us are somewhat familiar, at least, with how a lawsuit goes, but few of us really know anything about how a class action lawsuit works. And, of course, you were involved in a class action lawsuit when it came to Cobell versus Salazar. So maybe, if you will, tell us about how a class action lawsuit works and how this particular case became a class action.
Okay. First, this case started out as a class action lawsuit, and it was brought on behalf of a class of over 500,000 individual Indians, and the court approved its status as a class action in 1997. Now, how a class action is brought generally is there are a select number of class representatives. In this case, there were five, Eloise Cobell being the first in the list, and that's why her name appears. And indeed, she has acted as the first class representative by doing incredible work over these 15 years driving this litigation. But how a class action works is essentially sometimes there are claims that are so small that an individual person would never couldn't afford to bring them. So they couldn't afford to hire an attorney for the amount of money in dispute. But when thousands or hundreds of thousands of people have the same exact or similar claim, it makes sense for a class action to be brought, because then collectively the amount of money and the interests at stake rise to the level that they can be prosecuted as an action. So that's kind of the theory behind a class action. And in this case, it was brought as a class action because there are just that over 500,000 individual Indians, many of whom don't have the financial resources to bring a piece of litigation of this nature. And if they had to individually bring their own lawsuit, they would never be able to get an attorney who would be willing to fight for it, because they might have very little money either up front to be able to pay or very little money at stake in their claim. But they have very important rights that needed to be adjudicated and protected, because they need this information. It's their trust land, and they have every right to the information that the government is supposed to maintain and provide.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Gilder. How did Eloise Cobell manage to hire a legal team to represent her case? You know, it was a good case based on what has happened with this settlement. But as you said, that it can be very expensive to bring a lawsuit. So why didn't she have the same problem trying to retain legal counsel that most other people do?
I will tell you that she did, actually. At first, she was turned down by several law firms saying not only did they think the case was impossible to bring, but that they weren't financially capable of doing that. Eventually, she did find several attorneys who not only believed in the merits of the case, but were willing to take the case on what's considered a contingent nature. So they took the risk that they might not win the case, but if they did, they will be rewarded at the end of the case. Those attorneys that started this case were Dennis Jingold, who's the lead counsel still, and an attorney named Thad Holt, who has still contributed to the case but doesn't work on an active basis these days. But those attorneys, along with some other attorneys that have worked on this case, really believed in this case and were willing to take the risk. And also Eloise was able and willing to go out and raise funds from different charitable organizations that support both civil rights and indigenous rights. And those organizations provided grants in some cases that helped defray some of the expenses throughout this litigation. Right. And it actually, Ms. Cobell herself, who was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, donated almost all of the MacArthur Genius Grant money to fund this litigation.
If you're just joining us, this is Meet the People. I'm Kels Hetherington, and my guest is attorney Justin Gilder. He was on the legal team that won a multi-billion-dollar legal settlement in the case of Cobell versus Salazar. Personally, Mr. Gilder, I have never heard of these individual Indian money accounts. How do they work? Do people actually know that they have them? And is someone able to go online and look at their balance or take money out? How do these things work?
Well, first, many people do know that they have these accounts. In fact, most of the beneficiaries know that they have an individual Indian money account, although there are many that think they should have accounts and should have accounts but do not. Part of the problem and part of the reason why this lawsuit was brought was because the Department of Interior and the Department of Treasury kept very, very poor records over the history of this trust. And the trust was horribly mismanaged for a number of years. And this is not my opinion. The Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. has concluded this. And Congress has written reports from as early as 1914 to as recently as 1992 detailing the problems, the pervasive problems crippling this trust system. The individual Indian money accounts, I would say in a perfect world, would have that beneficiaries would have that capability of going online and looking at their records and knowing that their balances are accurate. But given the history of this case, A, that's not possible to have an accurate determination of an account right now, although this case will settle those claims and state accurate balances as of a certain date if the court provides final approval of this settlement. And then in the future, perhaps the management will be sufficient enough so that they can establish online bank statements and things of that nature. But I think we're years away from that right now. The Interior Department and Treasury Department will send out statements to the beneficiaries that they have a valid address for. And they do not have valid addresses for every beneficiary, unfortunately. And they do not have an account for every beneficiary that they should have an account for. So that's in some ways part of the problem about accessing money to the settlement, which we can talk about later.
Well, on average, Mr. Gilder, what would you say should be the average account balance in these individual Indian money accounts?
You know, it's tough to say on average because there's a problem that has plagued the system, which is called fractionation. And fractionation is essentially the whittling down of what was once a whole parcel of land into very small interests, because often when a person has died, they have given their interest in land to all of their living heirs. And so some lands have started off as, say, 160 acres or 80 acres, and over 120 years have broken down so they have sometimes thousands of owners on very small parcels of land. So in those cases, the amount of money in the accounts is very small because each person is sharing in what is one collective piece of land that may have or may not have valuable resources. And they vary by region. So some regions, you're going to have oil and natural gas on land. Some regions, you're going to have only grazing leases. And in some lands, you're going to have rights of way for power lines. It varies throughout the country. So giving an average figure would be difficult.
All right, that's fair enough to say.
Yeah. The total in every given year is roughly $400 million going through these accounts.
In revenue generated from the lands that are held in trust?
Yes.
All right.
In the history of this trust, over $15 billion have been generated.
Wow, that's substantial.
And that's a conservative estimate.
Now, there has, of course, been a settlement reached, and it's $3.4 billion. But break it down for us. What is that worth?
The terms of the settlement as of now are $3.4 billion. $1.5 billion will be distributed to individual Indian money account holders, and that's broken up into two categories. One part of that will be for the historical accounting I was talking about earlier. No beneficiary will receive a historical accounting, and because of that loss, there's going to be a $1,000 payment to each beneficiary that had an account between roughly 1985 and December of 2009. And each of those $1,000 payments is for the loss of the historical accounting. And then the other portion of that $1.5 billion will be paid out to beneficiaries based on their status as landholders. So some people in this settlement have land, and some people only have accounts for other types of settlement money that has gone through and been paid to them. So anybody that has land is going to get additional money, and that's for the mismanagement of their assets, being those natural gas rights, those oil, the timber, the minerals that have been generated off of their land. And each beneficiary is going to get a different payment based on how much activity has gone through their account, with a minimum payment of roughly $500. So a total minimum payment of about $1,500 for each beneficiary.
That's only part of it.
This $100 million pool within that $1.5 billion that's going to be used to increase the lowest payments made to beneficiaries. And we've estimated that that will roughly bring the lowest payments from $1,500 to $1,800.
Yeah, and there's also a $1.9 billion slice of the $3.4 billion settlement at large, and that is going to be used to buy up fractional interests of land. Is that correct?
That's correct. That $1.9 billion is going to be available for any individual Indian who wants to sell their fractionated land, and that's a very important distinction, especially in the history of federal Indian policy with regard to land. There's no forced sale here of land. Any individual Indian who's willing to sell their fractionated land, of which there are many that I've spoken with and other members of the legal team have spoken with, people are willing to sell their land, and this is going to be an option to allow that process to happen. And part of why that's happening is because it's become so administratively difficult for the federal government to manage this trust, at least that's the way they've phrased the problem, because of this fractionation, this whittling down of interests until sometimes 1,000 people own one parcel of land. So the federal government has said that they're going to be able to more easily manage and better manage this trust if they're able to consolidate the lands. And so the fractionation fund is going to be available for willing sellers to sell the government their interest in land, and then that interest is not going to go to the federal government as federal land. It's actually going to be consolidated under most likely tribal ownership. As of right now, that's the plan in place. It's going to be given to the tribe whose jurisdiction the land falls under.
Again, if you're just joining us here on the radio, this is Meet the People. I'm Kels Hetherington, and my guest is attorney Justin Gilder. He was on the legal team involved in a case called Cobell versus Salazar, in which a multi-billion dollar settlement has just been announced. Meet the People airs live in Sandpoint and in King Cove on 830 AM KSDP Radio, and is distributed by the Native Voice One Radio Network. Mr. Gilder, if someone is listening to this program and suspects that they may have an equitable interest here, how do they go about finding out if indeed they do qualify for a share of the settlement?
What a person would need to do is either call a 1-800 toll-free number, which is 1-800-961-6109, or they can visit the website indiantrust.com. And on that website, and by calling that phone number, they'll be able to access information that gives them what's called a claim form. And by filling out that claim form, they're going to register to participate in the settlement. Now, there'll be a period of time after the court gives final approval where a claims administrator is going to determine whether the person has an interest. For some people, they receive what's called a quarterly or annual IIM statement of account. If a person receives that statement, they're automatically a part of this settlement because the Interior Department has a record of their account, and we know that they're an account holder. For some people who think they should have an account or for whom they do not receive one of those statements, but they know they've had an IIM account in the past, it's important to fill out this claim form so that the name and information can be entered into this database that's going to be evaluated ultimately in the end by the court to determine who's in the settlement.
Are payouts from the settlement subject to personal state or federal income tax?
No, I'm very happy that you asked that question. This is actually a very important feature of the settlement. No money that's paid to an individual Indian as a result of this settlement is subject to federal taxation. It will not diminish that person's right to federal benefits for any federal program. So for the wealthier beneficiaries, this will not be a taxable event. And then for those poorer beneficiaries who in some ways struggle to subsist and they subsist on government benefits, this is not going to take away that right. So it's not really going to be giving up some federal subsidy just to get this payment. And we thought long and hard during the negotiation process in the settlement about that very issue. And it would really be a ridiculous settlement for most of the class members if they were to lose their access to federal benefits but then get paid a certain amount of money, because they're owed this money for historical injustices, and it has nothing to do with their current need to be on federal subsidies.
Is the tax-exempt status of this particular settlement unique, or does it happen anywhere else?
In some cases, there are other tax-exempt legal settlements, very few, and they are mostly in personal injury cases. This is a very different situation, and this is a very unique situation and a unique feature of this settlement. There are two things, though, that why this is part of it. One, I mentioned before about protecting the poorest beneficiaries, and the other is there's the income that's generated off of individual Indian trust land is tax exempt normally. So this money shouldn't be taxed when it would have normally been generated by off of individual Indian land. So we're preserving and protecting that normal tax status. And Congress, when they authorized this settlement with ratifying legislation, they put in a provision that ensures this tax-exempt status.
Mr. Gilder, how does anyone know if they're getting a good deal or a bad deal if they haven't gotten account statements maybe?
That is definitely one of the challenging parts of this case that's really been a troubling part of the case for years. And it's something that's not easily answered.
All right, just a couple more questions. I'm talking with attorney Justin Gilder about the settlement in the Cobell versus Salazar case. What happens if you qualify for a share of the settlement and you simply fail to make a timely claim? What then, Mr. Gilder?
If you qualify for the settlement and you fail to make a timely claim, there is a possibility that you will not be a part of this settlement, which is why I really encourage people to, if you think you are a part of this settlement or you think a family member or a friend is a part of this settlement and they haven't heard about it, tell them, because it's important to spread the word to as many people as possible. And filing a claim online is very easy. Calling the 1-800 number and having a claim form mailed out is very easy as well if you don't have internet access. And the claim form is not a very detailed form. You do not need to spend hours filling this out. You can fill this form out in a couple of minutes, and it does not ask for detailed information. Nobody's going to need an accountant or a lawyer to help them fill this form out. It's very self-explanatory. We have worked very hard to make this form easily digestible by anybody that reads it so that there are no questions. And in some cases, these forms are available in other languages for the individual Indians that speak or read a native language.
So if you're a native Alaskan person, would it make sense for you simply to file a claim and then let the government decide whether or not you're entitled to a share of the settlement?
Well, let me be clear. It won't be the government that decides whether you qualify. There'll be an independent claims administrator that will decide and make a recommendation, and the court will ultimately make a determination based on a variety of factors. So if somebody thinks they are a part of this settlement, absolutely, I would encourage them to participate. I've said before, I think from a legal standpoint, this is a very fair settlement. I think the most amount of money that could be obtained for the individual beneficiaries has been obtained. The litigation was contentious for 15 years. The settlement discussions that took months were very contentious. This was not a case that was settled easily or without much debate, consternation, and thought. And a lot of work went into the settlement, and as much as could be obtained was obtained.
How long is it going to take for the committee and the courts to approve and to start to distribute the settlement? What's the timeline?
The court date that's set right now for what's called final approval hearing is June 20th. So that date may slip a little, but most likely the court will hold a hearing on June 20th. And at that date, the court will hear argument about why this settlement is fair and reasonable. And it will consider all of the statements that are sent in by beneficiaries, all the comments and objections, and it will decide whether this is a fair and reasonable settlement. There's then a period of 2 months where if anybody chooses to appeal, there's time where they could appeal to the Court of Appeals and ask the court to review what the district court approved.
All
or
right.
Denied. And so it will hopefully be mid to late summer that we have a real firm date of approval.
That is Meet the People. You've been listening to my interview with attorney Justin Gilder about the recent multi-billion-dollar settlement in Cobell versus Salazar. Meet the People is produced at the studios of 830 AM KSDP Radio in Sandpoint, Alaska, and distributed by the Native Voice One Radio Network. I'm Kels Hetherington. Thanks for listening.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service. Thank you.